Morning, everybody, and good morning to our friends at Northside Campus as well. In the course of your life, on average, you will spend over 90,000 hours working. And that's if you only work 40 hours a week. And, of course, the truth is that over the last 30 years, the majority of Americans have started working longer hours while earning less. It's called increased productivity. According to a recent report by the Center for American Progress, the report finds that in 2006, American families worked an average of 11 hours more per week than they did in 1979. In Japan, 10,000 workers a year drop dead at their desks as a result of 60 to 70 hour work weeks throughout their lifetime. Now, of course, work is everywhere. We carry our work in our pocket. 25% of the people check into work hourly while on vacation via email and phone. Hourly on vacation. 59% said they check work during traditional holidays like Christmas and Thanksgiving. The result is that effectively for many Americans, a 72-hour work week is normal, which means you're really looking at well in excess of 100,000 hours in a lifetime. And of course, meanwhile, millions of others can't find work at all. And all this work is not making us more prosperous, and it's not making us happier, because the average American has 7 to 8 different jobs before the age of 30. And 80% of all Americans are dissatisfied with their job. We won't take a survey of hands this morning how many of you are dissatisfied with your job, but there are a lot of people unhappy with their job. We're doing a series called Be the Church, in which we're exploring what does it mean when we say go out and be the church at the end of every Sunday service. And for most of us, what follows during the week is mostly work. So does that have any connection to being the church? What you're going to spend most of your time on when you walk out of this building, does it have any connection? So in the next 2 weeks, we're going to explore how to be the church in your work and at your work. Now, it's interesting. The ancient Greeks' account of creation had the idea that there were successive ages of mankind, starting with the golden age when humans and gods lived together in harmony on earth and no one had to do any work. Sort of like early retirement. But those who follow the teachings of Jesus and his authorized messengers, called apostles, actually have a very unique and a very different view of work than the Greeks did. And what we have to say today, of course, applies to at-home parents who are working, usually not getting paid much, but working nonetheless. And it also applies to you if you're in school, because that is also work. So first thing that we need to understand is that from the Christian point of view, work is a gift from God. Genesis 2:2 and 15. On the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing, so on the seventh day he rested from all his work. Then on verse 15, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. In his book, Every Good Endeavor, Pastor Tim Keller writes, "In the beginning, then, God worked. Work was not a necessary evil that came into the picture later, or something human beings were created to do but was beneath the great God himself. No, God worked for the sheer joy of it. God creates a paradise, creates mankind, and then commissions mankind to work in the garden of paradise. Work is a part of paradise. Work is what God does. And work itself is a gift of God. Work allows us to express our desire for productivity and for creativity. It's how we create. And so work is a gift from God. Work had a glorious beginning. You know, it's not like, you know, we fell into work when things went wrong. No, it was like work was there right at the beginning. But number two, there are problems with work. Because the good gift gets messed up. Genesis 3, 17 to 18. To Adam, he said, because you listened to your wife and ate fruit from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. When Adam took the first step away from dependence upon God and towards the desire to be his own God, his connection with God was broken. And the loss of that connection brought ruin to the good gift of work. Since then, work is often cursed or twisted in ways that demean work and alienate us from the thing upon which we spend most of our waking lives. The thing that was meant to be a good gift has become something else. And there are many different ways it gets twisted. One way is sometimes work is frustrating. What we often experience is that work doesn't go as we'd hoped. We plant and toil, but weeds come up and spoil the crop. We work hard, and then someone else gets the benefit, or is just simply better than we are. No matter how hard we work, so often what we envision is so much more than what we can actually accomplish. Many of us want to do work that is something amazing for the world, but very few actually get that experience at all. And so sometimes work is just frustrating. Secondly, sometimes work is meaningless. Ecclesiastes 2:17 says, so I hated life because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. The teacher in Ecclesiastes is encountering the fact that it seems that at the end, when you die, what is the value of your work then? Sometimes we feel that our work is meaningless because it's not changing anything. But even work that changes things can ultimately become meaningless, as the teacher is telling us, because eventually all the accomplishments of our labor and toil will be wiped away by time and history. Eventually, your company, your school, your business will disappear or be swallowed up or go out of business. Eventually, all our buildings will crumble into ruin. This one's working on it this morning. With leaks here, there, and everywhere. Eventually, the earth itself will be destroyed when our sun runs out of fuel. And what will our effort mean then? Back in 1817, the poet Shelley wrote about Ozymandias, an alternative name for the Egyptian pharaoh Ramesses II. This is his most famous lines. He said, and here's how it goes. He says, I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on those lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Around the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. And so work, even the greatest works of the greatest kings, is meaningless. Sometimes work, we find, is selfish. When work becomes all about making a name or climbing the ladder or only about making money, we find it to be filled with a kind of selfishness that ultimately is alienating and discouraging. We may find ourselves working alongside people who have no other reason to work, people not easy to get along with, and whose motives are only for themselves. And it can be difficult to keep working in that way or in that situation, let alone enjoy it. But on the other hand, sometimes work gets twisted in a different way. Number four, sometimes work becomes our identity. When you take God out of the picture, then it's very easy for work to become the answer to the questions, who am I and why am I important? Those are some of the most important questions in our lives. Who am I and why am I important? And without God, it's easy to get a sense of importance, fulfillment, and reward from work instead of from God. And as a result, work itself becomes an idol that comes before health, family, friends, and spiritual life. And it's a big setup for disappointment. No one facing death ever said, I wish I'd spent more time at work. And what happens if you lose your job? Then you become a nobody with no purpose and no value. If you're a follower of Jesus, on the other hand, you need to be very clear that your purpose and your value and your identity comes out of your relationship with God, which will stand through all kinds of trouble and trial and loss, regardless of whether you work or not. Another very subtle way that sometimes our view of work gets twisted is, number five, sometimes we think only clergy work is spiritual. What I mean is we get this split between sort of the secular and the spiritual, and we think that only the spiritual is good. I do believe that God calls some people to serve the church in an exclusive way. That's what's happened to me. But the vast majority of those who follow Jesus are not actually called to do that. But it's easy to get the wrong idea that the real work for God is serving the church full time, and anything else is second class. So let me say it as clearly as I can. What is first class service to Jesus is to obey his call to whatever kind of work. And the kind of work I do is not inherently superior or more spiritual than the kind of work you do. So I find myself sometimes imagining a line of people meeting Jesus on the great last day. And each one is coming up and Jesus is making his comments and they're kind of telling Jesus, you know, the best they can offer from their life. And up comes someone who became a pastor because they thought it was more spiritual, but they weren't really called and very gifted for it, so the results were kind of mediocre. And this person comes up and says to Jesus, I spent my whole life working as a pastor. And Jesus says, oh no, you were supposed to be a scientist and win the Nobel Prize. Six, sometimes we think work should make us happy. Now, I admit there can be a certain joy in work, the joy of working, the joy of a job well done, the joy of accomplishment, especially when you're doing the work you feel you are made to do. But that's not the norm, and it seldom lasts for a whole lifetime. And even when it is part of your life, there's a lot of other non-joyful bits mixed in with it. Ultimately, work is not a very reliable source of happiness in life. Consider that right now, 80% of Americans say they are unhappy in their work. And a big chunk of the others, the other 20% are workaholics who are neglecting themselves and their families and should be more unhappy. If we get that kind of joy in work, we should be thankful, but it's not a right or even a reasonable expectation. Happiness in life is much more reliable, obtained from relationships. Relationships with God, with family, with church, and with friends. And sometimes work gets twisted because we see our work as only a platform for talking about Jesus. Oh, this is a tricky one. You know, while there is a kind of representation of Jesus that should happen at work, and we're going to talk more about this next week, it's not our main reason for work. And that is not the primary way in which we should understand our work. We're not just there so we can talk to people about Jesus. That's really actually demeaning to work and to us. If you're a teacher, The point of your work is not just to talk about Jesus to students and coworkers. Hopefully you teach them some algebra. If you're a math teacher or whatever. And if you're only thinking that it's about talking to them about Jesus, then it's likely you won't be a very good teacher. And that could be counterproductive. So that's a little kind of, you know, it's very easy to kind of get into that. It's very subtle switch into like, the only value in my work is like talking about Jesus. And even that is twisted. So if those are the problems, what's the remedy? How do we redeem work? What's a good way to think about work? Well, as we said, first off, of course, it's a gift from God. But next, number three, we need work within limits. What the creation story tells us is that we were made to work, and therefore we need to work. It's a basic human need, just like our need for food and friendship and rest and so on, all those things. Without meaningful work, we sense significant inner loss and emptiness. People who are cut off from work because of physical or other reasons quickly discover how much they need work in order to thrive emotionally, physically, and spiritually. You might not realize how much you need work till you don't have it. Tim Teller tells the story of Jay and Barbara Belding, who are entrepreneurs in suburban Philadelphia. For a while, Jay worked as a special ed teacher. And along the way, working with his students, he realized that most of them did not have any meaningful prospect for work in their future. So in 1977, he and his wife established a company that engages in a variety of labor-intensive packaging and assembly work that actually works for the special education people he once taught. These people would otherwise be completely unproductive, dependent on government aid. And Mr. Belding says, our people want to participate in the workaday world, to feel positive about themselves and to help pay their own way. So he's got this whole company, and everybody who works there is special needs. Special ed people. Hundreds and hundreds of them. And while we are made to work in significant doses, it's meant to have limits. And we need those limits. So the Bible directs us towards essentially a ratio of 6 days of work and one of rest. I'm the supervisor of our pastoral staff, and they are motivated people, let me tell you. And so I never like have to like check up on them. Are they working enough? Always my checkups are they getting the rest they need, and are they taking their days off and not cheating? Because I know they could easily work too much, which in the end endangers their work and could create a big future problem for me. You got that? Usually at the most inconvenient time. So you want to make sure they keep their ratios in the right place. Work is good within a certain limit. And may I add just one other thing for your thinking? Some of us are at this stage in life. When we retire, we still need some work in our lives just to be healthy. I mean, have you ever noticed that the older folks who work at least to some degree in their 70s and 80s tend to live longer? They just, like, they do better. Because why? Because they're working, and there's something in work that is good for us and that we need. So maybe you don't get paid before. Maybe you don't carry the same weight of responsibility. Maybe you don't do the nasty jobs anymore, but you still need work. So as I'm looking ahead, I'm keeping that in mind. So work is something we need. Number four, God has assigned and called each one to work. Ephesians 2:8. Anyone who has been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with their own hands, that they may have something to share with those in need. Not only do we need to work, but God calls us to work. Why? It says so we can be useful and so we can share it with those in need. Because then we become more of the people that we are made to be. And then number five, and this is one of the most important ones, work is a way to serve our neighbor. Work is a way to serve our neighbor. When I first moved to Chicago 40 years ago, I bought my first car. And before too long, I needed to find a reliable mechanic who wouldn't charge me an arm and a leg for things I didn't need done. And a church person referred me to some guy named Omar who was just getting started in business. And they said, this one is one you can rely on. He's the kind of mechanic most people love. Now, Omar wasn't the warmest or the fuzziest guy you ever met. Many of you have met Omar. He was not the warmest or fuzziest guy you ever met. He was like no-nonsense business, you know, tell me what's wrong, you know, and if you took too long, he cut you off. But he did good work, and his prices were very reasonable, and you never, ever had to worry about him doing work you didn't really need. And more than once in my life, the guy, like, manufactured parts himself, you know, jury-rigged something to make a car work a little bit longer when, you know, it shouldn't have been working anymore. And he was an over-and-above kind of person. He was so good that he only took new customers from referrals from existing customers. So if you were ever Omar's customer, it's only because somebody referred you, because if you just walked in off the street, he would turn you away. He'd say no. Like, I don't take people off the street. Only referrals from existing customers. Okay? And I referred hundreds of people to him over the years. Well, last fall, I heard the devastating news that Omar had retired and closed his shop. And for days, I wandered around in shock, thinking, what am I going to do? It was like, it meant a lot more to me than if, you know, the mayor dropped dead. It was like, mayors are dime a dozen, but guys like Omar. I guess a part of me wanted him to just keep working forever, at least until I was no longer around. Now, my point is simply this. The guy was a mechanic, but a mechanic who served for over 40 years and made himself indispensable. It's so that it's hard to contemplate life on the north side of Chicago without him. And there's something about that that's really important. When we work, we are serving our neighbors. In point of fact, we all rely every day on the work of millions of other people who are serving us. Millions of people working as service to one another can live much more effectively and comfortably than if each one had to do everything for themselves. Take for a minute, for example, the chairs you're sitting on. Just take a look at your chair. I don't know if you've thought about your chair. Have you ever thought about what does it take for that chair to sit there? Because for that chair to be there, somebody had to mine the metal. Someone else had to grow the plants out of which someone else made the fabric and the dyes, and someone else had to get the chemicals out of the ground out of which someone else made the foam, and someone else had to process the metal and shape it into the frame, and several other people had to transport all this stuff from here to there, and then finally someone else had to put it all together so you could just sit here today. And I'm not even mentioning the guys that make the screws and the this's and the that's. That were also a part of it. And along the way, bosses and accountants and insurance agents and the guys who put up factories and the lawyers who made the contracts and so on were also a part of the process. It took all of those people so that chair could be sitting right there. Now imagine if you had to do it all yourself to have a chair. You couldn't do it. You'd be sitting on the floor. So you see, all our work from what people think of as high to what people think of as low, all our work is actually service. Service to thousands and maybe millions of others. And so work is one of the chief ways in which we love our neighbors. So as Tim Keller points out, for those of us who follow Jesus, the question regarding our choice of work is no longer what will make me the most money and give me the most status. The question must now be, how, with my existing abilities and opportunities, can I be of greatest service to other people? Knowing that what I do, knowing what I do of God's will and of human need. See, so when we work, we are serving other people. Every kind of work. But more than that, number six, work is a way to serve God. Ephesians 6:7 tells us, serve wholeheartedly as if you were serving the Lord, not people. Now, think about that. In your work, where you work, you are to think about that you are there working for Jesus, not whoever your immediate human boss may be. And keep in mind that the apostle wrote these words in the midst of encouragement to those followers of Jesus who were currently slaves. Imagine slavery, forced labor with no pay, often what the world would consider the worst kind of work, and yet the apostle encourages them not to look at it that way. He says, even as a slave, your work is not meaningless or worthless. Your work, even though not paid, even though unjust, is work to God. You should look at it as serving Jesus himself, not those who hold you in slavery. And so that has become how followers of Jesus understand all work. When we work, no matter how bad our earthly boss is, no matter how hard the work or how bad the pay is, we should work with our whole effort and ability because we are really working for Jesus. So tomorrow morning or this afternoon or whenever you head out to work next, you should say to yourself, I'm off to work for Jesus. That might help just a little bit. And if you can do that, actually, it changes everything, actually. If you can start really thinking of it that way, it changes everything. Because then your work, no matter what it is, has great meaning and great purpose. You're not just working for the corporation or the bureaucracy or whatever. You are working for Jesus. But one more thing, number seven. Working to our greatest capacity is part of our worship. Colossians 3, verse 17, and then 23 and 24, he tells us, whatever you do, whether in word or deed, do it all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters. Since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. So here we see that working to our greatest capacity, with all of our heart, with all of our effort, working unto Jesus becomes actually a form of giving thanks. That is to say, a form of worship. You see, worship is not just singing love songs to Jesus. It's also giving our effort and our strength and our mind and our heart to Jesus. And when our work becomes worship, it gains something very special, and we gain something very special. Imagine, instead of just 100,000 hours of work, it's 100,000 hours of worship to Jesus. And it gains, it says here, an eternal reward. When our work becomes worship, it gains the power to outlast the ravages of time and history. And it lives on in the spiritual realm as worship. what history and time will wipe away cannot even begin to touch what happens when our work has been given to God as worship, because worship is right at the center of heaven, where time and history have no power. Right at the center of everything. In making our work worship, we free it from frustration, we free it from meaninglessness, and we free it from idolatry. In making our work worship, we make it back into the gift of God it was meant to be. The band can start making their way up here. One last point. The greatest work is to believe. John 6:29. Jesus answered, "The work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent." You see, obviously, this whole thing is dependent upon one thing. All of this reorientation and new understanding of work is completely dependent on this, that you are actually connected to God through Jesus and that you put your trust in him. That's what was lost in our fall away from God, way back when work was subjected to frustration, and that is the way back. If you want your work to matter, if you want work to work for you, then you've got to engage in the true work of God, which is to trust this Jesus sent from our Father in heaven to bring us back and to restore the world, including restoring work. If you're not sure you can do it, if you're not sure you can yet believe in Jesus, then just try this. Just ask him to show himself and his love to you. Just pray this prayer, even if you don't believe prayers work. Just say it for the sake of saying it as an experiment. Jesus, if you're really there, show yourself to me. Show me that you're real. Now, you can't specify how. You can't say, like, you know, get me a Mercedes-Benz, and then I'll believe it. Okay, it doesn't work like that. You have to leave it open-ended. But ask him to do it somewhat and see what happened, because millions have said exactly that and found that when they did, something amazing happened. Lots, in fact, of amazing things started happening in their lives. But maybe, on the other hand, you've been in that process for a while, and you're starting to find belief in your heart, then why not take that step right now of turning your life over to following him and trusting in him? All you have to do is tell him. Just say it right now while you're sitting. Just say to Jesus, "Jesus, okay, I'm ready. I'm ready to trust you to turn my life over to you." And for all of us, no matter where we are in our spiritual journey, let us then give our work back to God. Because that is what we mean when we say, go out into the world and be the church. Let's stand and respond to the Lord in the song. All right, now let's pray. Our God, we are just so thankful for every opportunity that we have to work. We pray right now for those in our midst who are looking for work and don't have work. Would you open up those doors for them, Lord? And give them a place where they can serve and be productive and be able to share with those in need. For those of us who have work, Lord, help us to understand it in a whole new way as we walk out of here, that it is your gift that is to you, that it is worship to you, and that we in our work are servants to the world, to our neighbors. And as we do that, Lord, will you change it into something special, something eternal, rather than the frustrating and meaningless things it so often becomes. That's our prayer this morning, Lord. Amen.